Was President Obama born in Kenya? Well, no. You can look at his birth certificate online if you're really so inclined. But ever since people started making that completely false allegation, the issue of presidential eligibility has been in the news. Article 2 of the Constitution restricts the eligibility for a highest elective office only to, quote, natural-born citizens. But what does that mean? The issue's back in the news now because one of the leading Republican candidates, a fellow by the name of Ted Cruz, was born in Canada. Though he claims he's still a natural-born citizen. Is he? Is he eligible? What about this provision in the Constitution? Today we've got two experts, and we'll try to enlighten all of us. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about whether Ted Cruz can be president.
Welcome to your Weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Article 2 of the United States Constitution restricts eligibility for our highest office, that of President of the United States, only to, quote, natural-born citizens. But what exactly is a natural-born citizen? Most people agree that if you were physically born within a state of the United States, you probably qualify. Unquestionably, you qualify. But what about other people? What about the children of American citizens who are born overseas? What about the children of one American citizen and one foreign citizen who are born in another country, like presidential candidate Ted Cruz, who apparently was born of a Cuban father and an American mother, but in Canada? What if you were born in a territory of the United States, like Barry Goldwater was in the territory of Arizona before it became a state? What if you're born overseas in the Panama Canal Zone like John McCain? It is a really significant question. Right now, we're going to talk to two experts in that. Later on, we'll talk to Mary Bridget McManaman of the Delaware Law School at Widener University. And first, we'll speak to law professor Tom Lee of Fordham University.
My name is Thomas Lee, and I'm a professor at Fordham Law School in New York. I teach international law, constitutional law, and various courses on litigation in the federal courts.
Well, my gosh, that sounds familiar. What are we going to talk about today that has to do with all that good stuff? Oh, I remember. It has something to do with Ted Cruz, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Okay, what are we going to say about him?
Well, there's a provision in the Constitution, in Article 2 of the Constitution, that says, among other things, that anyone to be eligible to be president has to be a natural-born citizen. And there are questions whether Mr. Cruz, because he was born in Canada to a U.S. citizen mother, but a father who was either a Cuban or a Canadian national at the time, qualifies as a natural-born citizen, as those words are used in the Constitution.
Yeah, and this is an issue that, of course, is very much in the headlines right now, and I believe its primary protagonist here, or the person who's supporting it the most, is Donald Trump. But it's an issue that's arisen many times in our history, hasn't it?
Yes, there have been instances where, for example, George Romney, born in Mexico, John McCain, born in the Canal Zone. It has come up before.
And Arnold Schwarzenegger, my personal favorite.
Yeah. He was a naturalized citizen. I published an op-ed, and there I said that basically there's no easy answer to this question, and it really depends on how you read the Constitution and what your theory of the Constitution is.
Oh, you really are one of those law professor types. You're just not going to give us a simple answer. Okay, well, what are the arguments?
Well, I say that basically, well, number one, the Supreme Court has never decided this question, so it's sort of live in terms of the fact that there's no clear answer. And some people think that when we read the Constitution, we should read it sort of consistent with fundamental values, but in light of present circumstances. And I think those people, academics call them living constitutionalists. I think if you have that view, then he should be eligible, because under current statutes, someone who was born outside of the United States to just one citizen parent, whether it's your mother or father, is a U.S. citizen. And so I think if you have that theory, that is a more flexible understanding, and the idea that the Constitution changes over time, then he probably is eligible, because we can't imagine a reason why somebody like that shouldn't be eligible to be president as long as they've lived in the United States and satisfy all the other conditions.
Okay, you've introduced the statutory stuff here, so let's clarify. Article 2 says only natural-born citizens can be that, but not containing any definition, then you have to look to some other source for your definition. And as you point out, naturalization is within Congress's power under Article 1, immigration issues, those sort of things. And under current law, somebody like Ted Cruz, born overseas to an American parent, would in fact be considered a natural-born citizen. So statutes are very important here, aren't they?
Right. I would disagree with one part of your statement.
Oh, please.
You said that someone born abroad would be considered a natural-born citizen. The statutes don't actually use that word. They just say citizen of the United States. Mm-hmm. There's only actually one naturalization statute that used that word, natural-born citizen, and that was the statute from 1790, and they changed it in 1795 to citizen of the United States. So
curiouser and curiouser, right?
Yeah, no, it's actually a very difficult question.
But as you say, under the at least the school of thought that is the living, breathing document theory, there's no reason that somebody like Ted Cruz should be disqualified on the basis of having simply been born abroad. We would consider him just as American as we would consider anybody else.
I think so. I mean, as long as he had an American parent, and that could be a mother. Mm-hmm. That all changes if you're an originalist. If you think that the Constitution has to mean what it meant when it was ratified, then the answer becomes very different.
Oh boy, well tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Constitution, the 10th state, New Hampshire, ratified in 1788. So we have to look at what natural born citizen in Article 2 of the Constitution meant in 1788. And there are various pieces of evidence out there that historians turn to, and one of them is that 1790 statute, and one thing that I believe is that basically it's very difficult, even though that statute uses the same words, natural born citizen, I don't think it's very easy to say that should, whatever we get from the immigration statute necessarily decides the meaning of those words as a condition on presidential eligibility. It's mm-hmm. It's sort of an apples and oranges thing, and it's just an accident or an interesting coincidence that you happen to use the same language. So then is, well, what does natural born citizen in the Constitution mean? And I think that the best answer there is they thought that it was who was born a citizen under principles of natural law.
Okay, so just to back up and just so that people are oriented here,
yeah.
an originalist is tethered very closely to what the original meaning of the phrases in the Constitution were. So as of 1788, the originalist would ask, what did those drafters mean when they wrote natural born citizen? So it's kind of hard to argue that 1790 was in their mind. So, you know, a statute that was actually passed in 1790, though that was close in time, it didn't precede 1788, so you're actually going to go to what existed as of 1788 in the common law of yep. Of the country. Okay, so what are those common law principles?
Right, and just a couple of minor disagreements with you. One is historians, sort of the cutting edge constitutional theories now, don't look so much at the original meaning of the drafters,
mm-hmm.
Because basically there were 55 men who attended that convention. So we try to look at we try to get a sense of what people would have thought
general
public, which is harder to figure out. And so it's a fine line to draw, but it's important for sort of democratic theoretical reasons. The second thing,
you know, go ahead, please. You had a second point.
Yeah, the second point is you said the common law at the time, and the common law was a very technical body of law. The common law was the law of England, and the United States adopted the law of England in many respects. But it was not the only body of law that the United States, and particularly the early Americans, looked at. And there was another body of law. Natural law wasn't just the common law. The idea of the natural law was it seems very strange to us today, but the idea was that there were certain general principles that were out there that created the legal order that we could discover, just like you could discover the laws of gravity.
Right? Yeah, that's always been a little puzzling to me, which is why I typically consider it the realm more of philosophers than others. But you're right. At that time, people actually were thinking that maybe you can just go out and discover principles that are going to be universally applicable, and they're just floating out there, whether you consider them products of nature or of a divine being or you know wherever they might come from. So, okay. So we're getting even more precise.
Yeah, and so natural then, at least for the American founders, it didn't have a religious connotation, right? Like today, natural law theorists are sort of a minority, but for hundreds of years, I mean, natural law was the mainstream. You'll read opinions from the 1800s where they say according to the law of nature or whatever, and it's not supposed to be religious. It was just the sense that they thought law was like science in a sense, and that there were natural laws. And so in 1788, there were two principles of natural law, or as applied to the law of nations, and that were out there. One was the law of soil, or jus soli is the term, and that was predominantly the English common law rule. And it makes sense because the English lived on an island. They had a very difficult relationship with the continent. And the rule there was your allegiance to the king depended on being born on English soil. So that was the common law rule.
Jus soli, and that's actually spelled with a J, right? J-U-S-S-O-L-I, right?
Yeah, it depends on how you anglicize the Roman, but you could be jus or jus soli. That's right.
Okay, good. If people want to look it up. Okay, so if you're born on the soil of England, you're an English citizen.
That's right. English subject, they said. Actually.
English subject, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's
I'm
all right.
Being too much of a lawyer, but these were terms of art.
Very, very important terms. You just keep correcting me if I get them wrong. Okay, go on, please.
So that was the rule. The other rule was called jus sanguinis, or jus sanguinis, and that was the law of blood. And that was an older rule. It was a rule that had grown out of, whereas the law of soil was a feudal principle that pertained in England, the island. The law of blood was the old Roman law rule, and that was basically you derived your allegiance, your citizenship, your subjectship based on descent from your father, mm-hmm. right? And that was the rule that had pertained in the Roman Empire. That was the rule that pertained on continental Europe. Slavery went through the mother, but citizenship went through the father.
Sorry, ladies. just another way in which sexism and the oppression of women was embedded in all sorts of unlikely places. But go on.
Yep. It was a different world in that respect.
Uh-huh.
So one of the interesting things is the law of blood sort of started penetrating England too. And you start like starting in 1350, there were these statutes that said even if you were a English subject born abroad, in certain circumstances, you were still considered, and they actually used the words natural-born subject, mm-hmm. right? And the statutes originally were for the descendants of soldiers, courtiers, or ambassadors that went abroad, and that makes perfect sense. Because and mostly at that point, it was about inheritance rights, because if you were serving the king and serving the king required in the performance of your duties, you had to serve abroad as ambassador to a foreign court, and you had a child, it seemed perverse to say that, oh, well, you lose your inheritance rights because you weren't born on English soil. So these statutes originally started, and I call these people public subjects. So they started allowing, they started calling these people natural-born subjects, right? And then a very interesting thing happened in England in the 18th century. They started. It's one of the things that I enjoy very much about doing constitutional history is you sort of learn so much about the world. And what happened in England was, mercantilism and English merchants started going abroad, and in the 1700s, Parliament started passing a statute that said, even if you were the child of a private subject, because it's good for England, for our people to go out and do business in other countries, if you have a child abroad, that child will be considered a natural born subject, and so there's no penalty in terms of inheritance and property holding and all these things. So those statutes started happening in the 18th century. Now, the older rule that if you were a public subject, your child was covered, I think that even William Blackstone, who was a very famous writer, he wrote a treatise about the common law of England that the Americans admired very much in the 18th century. Even he said at that point, the rule that the child of public subjects born abroad, children of them, were natural born subjects was part of the common law, right? So do you see what's happening? Like by the 18th century in England, the children of public subjects born abroad are definitely natural born subjects. They don't need statutes. But for these private merchants, the statutes still were required to make them natural-born subjects.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've been speaking with Professor Thomas Lee of Fordham Law School, who is quite the expert on the origin of this concept of natural-born citizen, which, as we've just heard, traces its way back to England and the concept of a natural-born subject, and it was something that developed over the course of centuries. After the break, we'll come back, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll return to our discussion with Thomas Lee, and we'll bring it up to the present day. Stick around. And now it's time for another constitutional quiz recorded live at Williamsburg at the Virginia State Finals of the We the People competition. Okay, now we have another contestant. Oh, it's another girl. Yay!
Hi, I'm Sydney Dudley, and I'm an eighth grader at Midlothian Middle School.
Have you got a quiz for Sydney?
I've got nothing here from Australia.
No, nothing at all.
Okay, here comes the question. I'm going to read it out, and I'm going to give you four choices. According to Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution, who has the power to declare war? Is it A, the Supreme Court? B, the legislative branch? C, the commander-in-chief,
ooh,
the president?
Mm.
Or is it D, the U.S. military? Who has the power to declare war?
I'm going to say C is my answer.
Wait just a second. Your answer is C?
My answer is C, the commander-in-chief of the army.
C, the commander-in-chief.
No.
Commander-in-chief.
The commander-in-chief of the army.
Oh, the president.
The president.
I meant C, like the president.
Okay, so you're choosing C. The president of the United States gets to declare.
I'll choose B.
What's B?
B is the legislative branch, I believe.
Why are you picking B all of a sudden?
Because Article 1's about the legislative branch.
Ooh, I see. It couldn't have anything to do with the fact that when you were talking about the president, everybody started booing.
Well, they kind of give me a little reminder.
Well, wait just a second here. He's the president. He's the commander-in-chief. He's a big, tough guy. He commands the Army and the Navy and the Air Force and the Marines and the Coast Guard. He can't declare that we're at war?
I'm just going to make my guess saying it's C, because the legislative branch is what the Article 1's based upon, so.
So you're going with the legislative branch, which is choice B, right? Choice B.
It is choice B.
I couldn't talk you out of the legislative branch.
Well,
I mean,
okay, I guess one sec, give me a sec. I think I'll say C, because the commander-in-chief of the army, okay, shut up, C.
Let's poll the audience. How many people say the president can declare war? I see a few hands. Okay, how many people think that it's the Congress, the legislature?
She doesn't want me to win, so she's trying to mess me up, so I'm just not gonna.
Sydney, I'm gonna give you a hint here. Take a look at your teacher and see which she picked.
I don't know where my my teachers are.
Oh, she's not here. Okay.
Okay.
All right, what are you going to go with?
May you repeat the options one more time, please?
So sure. I know. The options are A, the Supreme Court. B, the legislative branch. C, the commander-in-chief, the president of the United States.
I'm going to choose option B.
Or
that's
D.
That's my final answer, US. B.
B is your final answer.
Yes.
She's right.
She's right.
It's true.
Come on up, get your T-shirt,
it's
Sydney.
True.
You
got to
get in this school.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm in the middle of a fascinating conversation with Professor Thomas Lee of Fordham Law School, who's quite the expert on the origin and the derivation of this concept of natural-born citizen that's so much in the news lately, specifically with the eligibility of Ted Cruz to run and to become president. Let's begin with a summary of where we've been so far.
As of 1788, when our Constitution was ratified, your research shows that there were basically two ways to be a natural-born citizen. One of them is to be born here in the United States, if we follow the jus soli perspective. Mm-hmm. And the other one is to be born abroad of an American father, at least if the father's a public official, or perhaps even if he's a private citizen pursuant to the later adoption of the common law.
Exactly. So the question is, when they wrote it into the Constitution, did they? I think that they definitely intended public servants, right? I mean, right. The United States at the time, they didn't have soldiers abroad, but they certainly had ministers abroad, and
right.
I felt like that, you know, they would not have wanted to disqualify them. It's a harder question whether they would have disqualified the children of private subjects. But the one thing that's clear is it was a patrilineal society. It had to be your father, not your mother.
I think I know where we're going with this. Okay.
Right.
So that was the rule as of 1788. From an originalist perspective, then that's what the Constitution means. That's what it meant then, and therefore it's what it means now.
Well, that's what you believe if you're an originalist.
Right.
Now, one position could be if you're the child of a private U.S. citizen born abroad, I mean, you're not a natural-born citizen under these rules. And that's actually a pretty, you know, important position. I mean, the reason why I don't buy it is because, you know, if you read the Constitutional Convention debates, they don't particularly talk about this provision, but they do talk about the citizenship requirements for congressional eligibility. And they were surprisingly progressive. I mean, they have these discussions where they say, they had initially, you know, there's a 7-year citizenship requirement to be a congressman, and those rules were originally 3 for congressmen and 4 years for senators, and people were saying, look, we want to encourage immigration into our country, and we think that in order to do that, we have to make our political offices available to foreigners who come and are citizens for reasonable periods of time,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it seems to me that if I had the people in a room who were deciding these things and your basic American citizens, I think they would have said, like, look, if you happen to have been born to an American merchant who was in Rotterdam, right,
mm-hmm.
and then you came back with your family here, then you're going to be eligible. I think that basically they were pretty progressive in terms of wanting white European male immigrants to come to the United States, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were not as progressive with regards to gender. I mean, that's one thing that's very clear from the historical materials.
Indeed, indeed. Okay, so basically two ways. You're born here or you're born overseas if your dad's an American. So you were going to tell me...
Or if your dad was a public servant. Now, this is very interesting because some of the English statutes, they had mothers who were public servants, and that was because I don't know how well you know English history, Stuart, but for a while during the reign of William and Mary, the court spent a lot of time in the Netherlands, which is where they were originally from.
Mm-hmm.
So those statutes actually mention mothers, so they were courtiers who were ladies in waiting, probably serving the
queen.
Oh,
okay. So if you happen to be an American female official overseas, you might sneak in despite
exactly.
the sexism
just
of the time.
We didn't have any back then. Yeah.
We just didn't happen to have any. Okay, sorry again, ladies. All right, now bringing it forward, you were going to tell me about John McCain.
Right, so John McCain, He was born in the Canal Zone, which is out by Jus Soli, right? Because that's not
right.
And you can make arguments about the fact whether, you know, the Canal Zone has a special status because it was kind of quasi sovereign or not completely foreign sovereign territory. But I think he's in under Jus Sanguinis as to public citizens, because he was born, his father was a U.S. naval officer.
Right.
That's something that's near and dear to my heart, because I used to be a U.S. naval officer. But anyways, he was born to a naval officer who was doing his duty. And the reason why his son was born abroad was because his sovereign had ordered him abroad.
So, yeah, I remember when people raised this issue back when McCain was running for president, and I thought to myself, really? You're going to disqualify the son of somebody who's serving overseas honorably in our military? I don't think so.
Exactly. I think that would be perverse. And in fact, I think Blackstone, Mr. Blackstone, who wrote his treatise in the 1700s, he even concedes that the children of ambassadors and soldiers under common law are to be considered natural-born subjects. So I think that's pretty clear. But as I said, private citizens who go overseas, they're making a voluntary choice. They're not doing it because their sovereign ordered them to go abroad, right?
Yeah, so that's just part of the price you pay if we're going overseas, is your kid can't be president. All right, well, but Arnold is pretty clearly out. I mean, Arnold Schwarzenegger doesn't qualify as having been born here, and he didn't have an American father. So there's just no question under an originalist interpretation, which finally brings us back to Ted. So where does Ted stand under this originalist interpretation?
I think he's out. I mean, I think he's out because basically his mother was a U.S. citizen and his father wasn't, and he was born in Canada. Now, there is an alternative vision of the originalist story, right, which is that, well, if we look at the 1790 statute and we look at all those English statutes, the definition of natural-born citizen or natural-born subject in the English statutes was a moving target. Congress or the Parliament changed that definition repeatedly. And so the conclusion that we can draw from this is that Congress has the power under its Article I naturalization power to make whoever it wants a natural born citizen.
So it could do so retroactively.
Well, that's an interesting point, Stuart, because I think that the people who buy this theory would say that it would have to be under the naturalization laws at the time of your birth.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But
so
anyway, that's really getting down in the weeds, and I realize that sometimes you have to do that. But here's the great irony, of course, is that, you tell me, what is Ted Cruz's self-professed view of the Constitution and how it should be interpreted?
Well, he says he's an originalist.
So. Yeah, no, that's...
and that's an irony.
And there's an irony there, and that's what I'm laughing at. I'm not trying to take partisan shots here, but under Ted Cruz's own school of thought as to how to interpret the Constitution, therefore he's ineligible.
Yes. I mean, he could... And I think a lot of people do this. They could say, "Well, I'm originalist, but I understand that world was very different in terms of gender and race. And if it's a gender or race issue, I think that we should evolve, right?" I mean, he doesn't say that, but there are plenty of people who say that. They say, like, you know, I'm sympathetic to originalism, but I can't do it across the board.
Right.
He's not one of them.
Very, very interesting. Well, we're out of time, so Tom Lee, thank you so very much for sharing with us your very detailed research into this really fascinating area. And I fully expect if Ted Cruz gets the Republican nomination, I expect to see you interviewed on CNN and all the other networks repeatedly.
Well, thank you very much, Stuart. It was a great pleasure talking to you.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've just finished a really great conversation with Professor Thomas Lee of Fordham University all about the eligibility requirement, that natural-born citizen requirement that Ted Cruz is finding to be a little bit of a thorn in his side in this presidential election year. Now let's go to another law school, to the Delaware Law School of Widener University, and speak to another expert, see what she has to say about this.
Hi, I'm Mary Bridget McManaman. I'm a professor of law at the Widener University Delaware Law School in Wilmington, Delaware, and one of my specialties is constitutional law.
Well, wow, that sounds familiar. And you particularly know about Article 2 and the Natural Born Citizen Clause.
That's right. A couple of years ago, I was volunteering at a lifelong learning institute at the University of Delaware, and I was casting about for a topic that I thought would be interesting to my students who are senior citizens. And I just thought, gosh, they lived through, you know, the controversy over Barry Goldwater and George Romney and John McCain. And I thought, let me research this topic. And what I discovered was the meaning is pretty clear, but modern commentators seem to have forgotten what the original meaning is.
Mm-hmm. And the original meaning, of course, is very important, really, no matter what school of thought you follow. I mean, I think as Justice Kagan recently said, we're all originalists, or we're all textualists, I think she said, because at least most constitutional interpretation starts with a text and starts with the original intent. It doesn't necessarily end there, but we have to think about those things. And so what are your thoughts with regard to the original intent of the Natural Born Citizen Clause?
Well, as you probably know, it derives from the common law. And,
right.
You know, the number of phrases in our Constitution that do so, like writ of habeas corpus and right to jury trial. And the Supreme Court says, go back to English common law to find out the meaning. And when you trace it back through the English sources, it's very obvious and very clear that it means birth in the territory of the sovereign. And the sovereign here, of course, is the United States.
Jus soli, I think they call it, something
That's
like
exactly
that.
Exactly right, yes.
Okay, so basically you draw a line around the territory of the country, and if you're born here, good for you, but if you're not born here, not so good for you.
Right, if you want to be president.
If you want to be president, exactly, which an ambition not all of us have, but you never can tell.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if we go with original intent, then that means a lot of people actually would be ineligible, people that otherwise you would think would be eligible. I mean, people like John McCain?
Yeah, he's a slightly different, interesting wrinkle,
mm-hmm.
because he was born in one of our territories. And under common law, the territories were included. So, for example, Barry Goldwater, I don't think really had any, would have had a difficulty because he was born in Arizona when it was a territory.
Mm-hmm.
But shortly after the Spanish-American War, when we first acquired overseas territories,
mm-hmm.
you know, like Philippines and Cuba, the people born there, a number of cases were brought and made it to the Supreme Court seeking to have them declared natural-born citizens because they were born in American territory. And in a series of cases in the early 20th century, the Supreme Court ruled, and I'm quoting the language of the court, that these people were of alien races to Americans and therefore could not be considered able to handle our Constitution, and therefore it didn't apply. And I think McCain's, the best thing that he could have done would be, I mean, it never came to that, but, you know, say that the Supreme Court ought to overrule those cases as having been wrong when decided. And then he, of course, would have been eligible.
Very interesting. So we were thinking in terms of people, and in the case of John McCain, a white person, being in a U.S. territory, and that, in his case, the Panama Canal Zone overseas, and perhaps extending the jus soli rationale to his birth, or Barry Goldwater living in, as you pointed out, the Arizona territory, the courts were willing, perhaps, to allow that sort of natural-born citizenship. But when we acquire these other territories that were teeming with people who weren't necessarily of European extraction,
right?
And those people said, hey, now that we're a territory, we want to be U.S. citizens as well, then it sounds to me like a very racist decision the Supreme Court made.
It's embarrassingly so. I mean, the court makes no bones about the fact that these people, well, they say the American race, and of course one asks, well, what is the American race? But it's pretty clear they're speaking of European Americans.
Right. That's a remarkable thing. Just for the record, do you happen to remember the name of that case?
There's about a dozen of them, and
mm-hmm.
they're referred to as the insular cases because most of the territories were islands.
Right.
So Google insular cases, I'm sure you can come up with them.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today we're talking about the Ted Cruz problem, or previously the President Obama problem, or maybe the John McCain problem. And the problem is, who is a natural-born citizen, and therefore who is eligible to become the President of the United States? Right now I'm speaking with Mary Bridget McManaman of Widener University Law School, and we'll take a break, and then we'll come back and we'll finish our conversation, and maybe we'll even have a visit later on from our friends at PolitiFact. I'm just teasing you. Stick around. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish up our conversation with Professor Mary Bridget McManaman of Widener University Law School, the Delaware Law School at Widener University. And she's telling us all about that natural-born citizen requirement that Ted Cruz is finding to be well, not really a huge problem yet, but it could be.
So I think we've pretty well established then that, at least under an originalist interpretation, people like Ted Cruz are sort of in trouble, or at least potentially, if the Supreme Court were to rule them ineligible to be president.
That's right.
Because if I understand. Oh, I'm sorry. We keep going with each other. I'll just state it. Just because, of course, he was born in Canada.
Right. And I was just going to say, of course, it remains to be seen whether any of these cases that have been filed will make it all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Right. And there are some that have been filed, right?
Yes, there's, as far as I know, there's one in Texas, there's mm-hmm. one in Florida, and I believe there's one in Utah. There may be others, but those were the ones I had heard of.
Well, the first issue I think all of those plaintiffs are going to have is simply establishing standing to challenge Ted Cruz's candidacy. Are any of them other presidential candidates who could theoretically claim that they were damaged more than the average person?
No, they're all, as far as I can tell, they're all voters, so I think that would be the, you know, the rule that if your grievance is generalized, that is, it's the same as everyone else's, mm-hmm. you're not going to be able to bring the suit.
Okay, well, it'll be interesting to see if, I don't know, Jeb Bush or perhaps Hillary Clinton or whoever at some point were to challenge Ted Cruz's eligibility, then maybe at least they'd get over the standing hump, and maybe, just maybe, the Supreme Court would take the case, and maybe we'd get some definitive statement in this regard.
Right.
but that would all have to happen fairly rapidly if it were going to affect the outcome here. Be that as it may, is that your interpretation, or are you looking at it from an originalist viewpoint, or do you follow a different school of thought and reach a different conclusion?
Yeah. Yeah, I tend to be somebody who's originalist in this sense. I think it's important to see that the framers thought many of the provisions that they wrote were, if not elastic, at least, you know, movable, and that it could change with the times. But I also believe that, and this is based on the writings of some of the framers, that there were certain clauses in the Constitution that were crystal clear. For example, the letter that I'm thinking of mentions Article 3. You know, either an ambassador is in the case or not, so you either have jurisdiction or not. You know, mm-hmm. It's fairly clear. And to me, when you put the natural-born citizen in the context of the other qualifications, it's the president has to be 35 years old and resident here for 14 years. It seems to me that those three, plus the natural-born citizen, that those three requirements were certainly at the time of the framing crystal clear. And I think they would have expected that to continue throughout time and not to change.
Very interesting. Well, and I do note, and others have noted before me, that Mr. Cruz himself claims to be an originalist.
Mm-hmm.
So he, I guess, have a little bit of difficulty arguing in favor of his own eligibility if push came to shove. But anyway, I find it fascinating. I've always wondered, and this is not something I've researched, but, I mean, Article 2 was adopted in 1788, ratified 1788, we've subsequently amended the Constitution a number of times, and the particular amendment that I'm sort of intrigued by is Equal Protection Clause. Has anyone ever argued that not allowing certain citizens to attain the highest public office would in some fashion violate equal protection, that equal protection effectively undid the Natural Born Citizen Clause?
That's a really interesting argument, and I've never seen anyone argue it except when I began researching this, I saw a reference somewhere that Arnold Schwarzenegger was thinking of suing to have that clause declared unconstitutional, and I couldn't trace it back to anything more than just a comment in some tabloid paper, so I have no idea of the truth of that, but the only thing I can imagine is that he would be making that argument.
Yeah, I think we must read the same tabloids, because now that I think of it, I think that that's the when it first was brought to my attention. But just to think, it's an interesting argument. I mean, Arnold would simply say, I'm an American citizen. I'm just as much a citizen as anybody else. I've gone out and I've been elected governor of the most populous state in the Union. I've served in that capacity. And, you know, past governors of California have become serious presidential candidates, and they by and large have not been questioned. Why should I, as a naturalized citizen, not be able to do the same things that somebody who happened to be born within the country can do. And, you know, of course, since the Equal Protection Clause was enacted, you know, 90 or so years after Article II, one can simply argue that by a straight process of statutory amendment, statutory construction, that Article II was amended.
I suppose one question would be, excuse me, is becoming president of the United States a fundamental right? I mean, you mm-hmm. might have some difficulties with some of the precedent.
Yeah, you might. On the other hand, it might take just such a character who, with all the charisma and power and popularity, at least up to a certain point.
I'm not quite sure how popular he is anymore.
At the moment, he seems to be on kind of in a trough in his reputation. But Arnold's a fascinating figure, and that's actually what intrigued me back in the day, was the idea that, you know, he might actually push this. Mm-hmm. And there are others out there. In fact, I think there was a former governor of my home state of Michigan, and I forget her name off the top of my head.
Oh, I love her. Yes, I can't remember her name either, but she's fantastic.
We both love her, but we can't remember.
It's terrible. Is it Grantham?
Grantham, there you are. That was her name, Grantham. And she was a very popular governor. She was mentioned as perhaps a strong candidate for either the vice presidency or the presidency just a few years back. And then someone pointed out, well, she was born just across the river in Canada.
Right.
And having been born in Michigan myself, a few miles away from the border, it's always struck me as a very arbitrary thing. You know, if on the day of my birth, my mother had happened to be shopping across the river in Windsor, Ontario, mm-hmm. and had gone into labor, then I, who am very much an American, would not be eligible to have the highest office in the land under the original interpretation. It's just it's a striking thing when you think about all the various permutations.
The thing is that we have very little to go on as to why it was put into the Constitution. Mm-hmm. The clue we have is that when the draft of the requirements first came out, it only required that the president be a citizen and I think 21 years in residence. And then John Jay wrote a note to George Washington saying, let me hint, I think the commander-in-chief should be a natural-born citizen. And George Washington responds to Jay saying, thank you for your hint. And 2 days later, the draft of the requirements contains the phrase natural-born citizen. So I think they were concerned about unquestioning loyalty at time of war. And let me just share something with you.
Please.
I think it sort of seems to me not that bad a limitation. Three of my grandparents are from Ireland, and I'll mm-hmm. just take my paternal grandfather. If he would have been eligible for the presidency around the time of World War II, and I'm sure you know that Ireland took a position of neutrality because its choice was between the current genocidal regime and England, which had, you know, through the potato famine and otherwise, committed sure. atrocities against the Irish. And so he might have, although he loved America, became a citizen, you know, was very, very loyal, he might have made a different choice at World War II, thinking more of the Irish experience. So to me, I'm not uncomfortable in maintaining the requirement, even though I don't doubt that Cruz is loyal to America or anything like that. But
no, that's interesting. That's always the explanation I've heard as well. In fact, your comments raise two interesting things. First of all, just as a minor point, George Washington didn't say much at the Constitutional Convention, but I think he typically got his way. And I think that's kind of how it went, you know, these hints that were given. So that's fascinating. But beyond that, I think the issue of its original intent really did have to do with them worrying about, you know, some fellow from France coming over, you know, a Napoleon showing up and sort of bamboozling the country into electing someone who really didn't have the country's best interests at heart. But I always thought it was strange because a lot of our citizens at the time of the founding had very close connections to other countries, and many of them had not been born in this country. And
right.
So the very fact that they themselves could draw a line between someone who happened to have been born here and who happened to have come over at the age of five or something always strikes me as interesting. And similarly today, I mean, we have lots and lots and lots. We're a nation of immigrants. That's a truism. And lots of people feel strong ties to overseas. And the simple fact that they might have been born there or they might have been born here shortly after, you know, after their parents had emigrated, I don't know if I would necessarily agree with you that I would be concerned about their ties to other countries simply based upon the fact, you know, the location of their birth.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is saying, can we come up with a line to draw? Like, for example, did you come to the United States before the age of 12? You know, the thing is, something like that would certainly get rid of a lot of the concerns that they had, maybe, or that I had. In fact, you know, when you think about the first draft, which was citizens who had been here for 21 years, that you can craft it differently to be a better excluder of those you're worried about and a better includer of those you're not worried about.
Mm-hmm. Well, fascinating stuff, and I sincerely hope that at some point this issue will be resolved by the court. But as we discussed, it may never happen because these things tend to come up in the heat of presidential battles, and there'd have to be a great confluence of events before the court would ever take it up. But in the meantime, I guess we're just going to have to speculate.
Right.
All right. Anything you wanted to add to this, Mary Bridget?
No, I don't think so. It's been a fun conversation.
It has been a fun conversation, and we thank you very, very much for speaking with us today.
You're welcome.
Well, once again, it's time to hear from our friend from PolitiFact, Lauren Carroll. Do you have an interesting fact check for us today?
I do. I have a fact check of Rafael Cruz, who is the father of Ted Cruz, the Texas senator and Republican presidential candidate.
Now, before we go any further,
yes,
I want you to promise never to fact check anything my father says, because, man, he says some crazy stuff. But with that caveat, okay, I'm not running for president, so I guess
sure.
Rafael Cruz is fair game. What did Rafael Cruz have to say?
Yeah, and Rafael Cruz is actually a big advocate for Ted Cruz. He's a public figure, so he counts.
So he's part of this process. All right, he's fair game.
Yes. And Rafael Cruz, who is a pastor, said, prior to 1962, everybody prayed before school started, and the Bible was the principal textbook in all schools. So he was talking about a change that happened in the Supreme Court in 1962 and how it changed religion in schools.
I think I've heard of that particular case, and I think I know where you're going with this, but pray, continue. And,
sure.
And that was a pun, by the way.
I appreciated it.
All right.
All right, so there were two cases. There was a 1962 case, Engel versus Vital, that found that it's unconstitutional to require prayer at the beginning of the school day, as well as a case that happened soon after, the Abington School District versus Shemp, that found that school-sponsored Bible readings were unconstitutional. And so those are similar cases that found it to be unconstitutional to have required prayer in school and required Bible reading in schools.
Okay, now the only caveat I'm going to add to that is that we're talking about public schools.
Right.
Right,
yes,
okay.
Exactly.
You can still have prayers in Catholic school or other religious school. Okay, all right, okay.
Sure. So one of my colleagues did a look back at some of the history, and this was a little bit challenging to find, but we did find a survey in 1960 of superintendents of school districts, and about half of the people who responded, the superintendents, said that there were no homeroom devotional services or, you know, school prayer at the beginning of the day. And of the other half, said the superintendent said only sometimes it was happening in their school districts. Rarely did you find that every single school within a school district had prayer at the beginning of the school day. So in reality, it was not nearly as universal to have school prayer every single day, as what Rafael Cruz said.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's part of the fact check. And then the other part of the fact check was about Bible readings. And in the survey, they found that only 42% of superintendents said that schools had required Bible readings. So that kind of throws out the part of the claim that said that the Bible was like the primary textbook in a school.
Yeah, I thought that's where you were going to head with this, because he stated these both as rather absolute and extreme positions. Not everybody read the Bible in public schools. It was commonly done, I mean, as your surveys indicate. And I'm not sure that any public school used the Bible as the primary textbook, especially not, for example, in an algebra class.
Right.
Or you know, yeah, it's just it's a bit of an overstatement in both cases. Is that where you all came out?
Sure, yeah. The rating we ended up with was mostly false because there was some truth to the fact that prior to these Supreme Court rulings, it was much more widespread, especially in the southern states and the northeastern states. However, it wasn't universal, which is the picture that Rafael Cruz was trying to paint.
Right. And that's very, very important because your baseline is often determined through rose-colored glasses. A lot of people who espouse what they describe as traditional values or perhaps conservative values will point back to halcyon days when supposedly everybody did something, whatever it might be, and turns out maybe life was not quite as simple and straightforward as some of those descriptions would lead us to believe.
No, certainly not. And I mean, these issues are still being debated today. I mean, cases as recently as 2000 and 2001 are debating the types of prayer, student groups, and religious programming you can have within a public school. So it's no more decided. Well, maybe that's an exaggeration, but I mean, it's still a topic of discussion today.
Right. We've always been a nation of many different people with many different belief systems, and though certainly most people would at least nominally identify themselves as Christian of one sort or another, there are many differences in these various denominations, and in fact it's been some of the differences between those denominations and certainly between different parts of Christianity that have caused a lot of problems. Something I learned about doing some research a few years back was something called the Bible Riots in Philadelphia, which I found shocking. It's not something I'd learned about in school, but apparently there was a huge series of riots, really almost a war in the city of Philadelphia. I think it was back in the 1840s because there was a dispute over which Bible should be used in the public school. Should they use the King James Version, which most of the local Protestants wanted, or should they use something called the Douay Bible, which is one that's apparently favored by Catholics? And they had people shooting cannon at one another. In the streets of Philadelphia, which is why I refer to them as the Bible Wars, because anytime you've got artillery, it seems to me you've gone beyond riot. And they had to bring in the Pennsylvania militia to calm things down. So we've never been quite as homogeneous as some people would have us believe. And one other caveat to all of this is that what these decisions only apply to government-sponsored schools, that is, public schools. And then the other one is that it's only they only apply to school-sponsored or school-sanctioned prayers. Individual students, even in public schools, can pray whenever they wish. Certainly they can do so silently. They can even pray out loud as long as it's not something that disrupts the educational process.
Sure. It's all part of this delicate balance in the First Amendment between not establishing a religion but also not prohibiting free exercise of religion.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Why, thank you.
Well, thanks, Lauren Carroll. I appreciate it, and we'll check in with PolitiFact again sometime soon.
Anytime. Always happy to.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Thomas Lee of the Fordham University Law School, and of course also to Mary Bridget McManaman of the Delaware Law School at Widener University. Both of them gave us those great perspectives on presidential eligibility. Thanks also to Lauren Carroll of PolitiFact. We really enjoy hearing from her, as always. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris. And oh, there was one person we didn't speak to. Arnold. But he might be president one day. You know, he always comes back. Next time on your weekly Constitutional, Article 2 requires that you be a natural-born citizen before you can take the oath of office to be President of the United States. But what exactly does that mean? And more specifically, is Ted Cruz eligible in this presidential election year? Join us as we speak to a couple of experts on the subject, and we promise we won't be taking sides.